Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, wonderful audience, wonderful folks, pioneers in the field, outstanding clinicians, citizens who have been injured by psychiatry or had their loved ones injured, professors, researchers, U.S., Canada, Great Britain, and also further around the world. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. I'm ebullient today. I'm fresh back from 5 days in Columbus, Ohio, three of which were at the conference with Pam Popper that she and I sponsored this year, which is bringing together a general resource center that we're building for all of medical and nutritional issues, and now more and more including psychiatry. Pam's theme is that folks need to have freedom of choice and access to information. And all of us, I think, can agree on that, especially my guest today, whom is one of the most interesting people I know. And let me check and just see if he's there. John, you there?
I am, Peter.
Oh, good. You sound real, real clear. Real clear. So I just got back yesterday, and the only activity I scheduled for today was being on the radio, though, of course, there's all these millions of things going on. I want to just give a shout out to Peter Goetze from Denmark, who I invited to the conference as a co-sponsor and who just delivered incredible speeches, inspiring speeches on the whole subject of misinformation in medicine and in psychiatry, and who is just a wonderful man. I'm just so glad to be working with him. And any of you in the psychiatric reform movement certainly should know who he is. His last name is spelled G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E, Peter Goetze. And you'll be staying in touch with him by staying in touch with this program. I'm just really pleased in general with how things are going. Yesterday we had 12,000 visits to my website, breggin.com. Folks, that's starting to approach that's millions of people over the year. That's millions of people. That's around 4 million people a year at that clip. Up to now, the clip has been about 3 million a year. So, and a part of this is my frequent alerts. And I was so glad to see on Breggin.com, the frequent alerts, a number of people who came to the conference because they had been following frequent alerts. It's free. Just go to Breggin.com and sign up for frequent alerts. And I try to get one out each week. I'm going to be about a day or two late because of the conference. Those are some of the main things I want to talk about today. I'll have some interesting new information on the frequent alert this week, and I'll give you some quotes, some of the ideas of Peter Goetze from the conference. Things are heating up in the reform world, both in Europe, where Peter has now become certainly the shining light, a physician, a resource, a researcher, and highly respected as the co-founder of the Cochrane Group, which monitors psychiatric and more general medicine. Until he got into the psychiatric arena, he's become quite concerned about that, and who gets articles published in the best of journals. The worst of journals, but the journals that have the widest circulation. and the most so-called prestige within the institutions of the world, but they're the worst journals, not the best. Well, I think that's it for my introduction here. We're going to be talking to John Rappaport. John is someone I have an enormous amount of respect for. I've known John for many years. He's somebody who always brings new insights and new information. He's been a freelance investigative reporter for, 3.5 decades. I don't think he's anywhere near as old as me, though. He's written lots of articles on medicine and health and politics, LA Weekly, Spin Magazine, Stern, CBS Health Watch, lots of different sources. He writes blogs on his own website. And he's put a lot of interest into uncovering research fraud in the areas of psychiatry and general pharmaceutical practice. And I think probably John and I should be talking much more than we do. I've been very concerned about the opiate epidemic, as have been, of course, millions of other thoughtful people around the country. I've had on before Red Lawhern, you can find by going to my website and going to the radio show, then going to where you can actually search alphabetically. If you put in LAW, you'll get Red Lawhern. And I think that John always has a fresh, insightful view into what is going on. He spells his name Rappoport. Hey, John, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Peter. It's been a long time.
Has it been? You know, you just need to call me once in a while because I'm just a terrible friend. I just don't ever get around to staying in touch with people. And you're going to always welcome on this show. So you call me when it's been a long time, and I'll try to remember to call you.
Okay, it's a deal.
So do you want to catch up the audience on anything you're doing now or writing, or you want to just launch into the opiate epidemic? And, folks, I may be taking notes. You may hear a little click from my
I think we should computer. Get into the opioid epidemic because – it's a lot worse than people think it is, even those who understand a lot about it. Most of this information is open source, although I will describe an insider that I interviewed at length who has been battling against this epidemic for a long time, and he had some very insightful information to pass along. But, of course, we're talking about drugs like morphine, fentanyl, which is 100 times more potent than morphine, which is quite fantastic in itself. Percocet, Percodan, Vicodin, those kinds of drugs, painkillers for severe pain. But what people don't understand is that in the trafficking realm, that is the illegal sales, which is really overrunning the planet, we have drugs like carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer, 10,000 times more potent than morphine. Instant death. You take a very tiny amount, you die. That drug, as well as designer opioids, spin-offs of, say, fentanyl, coming from underground Chinese labs up through Mexico into the United States, are also extremely potent. And the DEA is warning its so-called first responders, people who interdict shipments, to be extremely careful about what they inhale or get into a cut, because some of these designer drugs and the carfentanil can cause you to die immediately. This is not addiction. This is death. And to make the situation much more complicated, let's look at this, for example, as a powder that is illegally trafficked. The carfentanil, the designer versions, can be mixed in with traditional opioids like fentanyl so that nobody knows, including the dealer, including the addict, what they're ingesting. So it is an epidemic way beyond what anybody is really considering these days, I'm afraid. It's getting worse.
How big do you think it is in the U.S.? Can you describe it in the terms of how much of this stuff is out there, how many people are getting hurt, or whatever your best estimates are?
Best estimate is about 30,000 deaths a year. And that's shocking enough, but here is something even more shocking. CBS News reports, based on a survey, that in the year 2015, approximately 91 million adults in America took an opioid. This would be prescribed, legal, not trafficked. So we're not even counting the trafficking. 90 million or 91 million adults took an opioid. Now, obviously, all these people were not in severe agonizing pain, not even close. So we're talking about an incredible amount of addiction, and this is spreading all over the globe. We're talking Canada. I've had reports from there. Australia, England is experiencing this now, including the designer versions. So 30,000 deaths a year or more, nobody really knows. 91 million U.S. adults took an opioid by prescription in 2015. That's quite incredible.
It is.
Mm-hmm. So let's look, for example, when we look at the pipeline of how this works. I'm talking now about the illegal trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
When I spoke with my inside source, I said, look, I've read the articles that will tell you out in the middle of nowhere, in a state like, say, West Virginia, in a small town, there will be a tiny medical pain clinic or a pharmacy that supposedly has an inventory of a million opioid pills. How is it possible that this occurs, and how can they possibly sell all of this? And he said, well, this is the way it works. Let's imagine this little tiny clinic. First of all, they've got one or two, let's say, rogue doctors, medical doctors, who are writing anywhere between 50 and 100 opioid prescriptions a day. These are not necessarily geared specifically to patients, because the people coming through the door are not really patients. They're pretending to be. They fly in from all over the country. They are dealers. They buy a prescription and they get it filled either at the clinic or at a tiny pharmacy. Who these operations are obviously trafficking, and they know they're trafficking. The dealers return home. They distribute the pills to street dealers who then sell them to addicts. I said, okay, so let's take the example of this tiny pharmacy out in the middle of nowhere. And he also said, by the way, that the DEA has tracked dealers who book regular flights once a month, like clockwork, to come into this tiny pharmacy in the middle of nowhere. They fly in, they get their drugs, they fly home every month. I said, well, where does the pharmacy get a million opioid pills, which he told me could be sold in a year? He said they get them from distributors. I said, well, what's a distributor? He said it's a legal company that sells or distributes. It's like a middleman that distributes many medicines to pharmacies all over the place. I said, so in other words, these distributors know that they're traffickers. Oh, yes, he said. I said, well, where do the distributors get their drugs from, their opioids? From the pharmaceutical manufacturers, he said. So I said, so they and the distributors both know that they're involved in trafficking. He said, absolutely. I said, they have a nudge-nudge, wink-wink relationship. He said, oh, no, it's far more intimate and serious than that. They know exactly what they're doing. Example, Purdue Pharma had revenues from OxyContin of $35 billion busted by the federal government.
What Eventually, was it for?
For OxyContin.
For OxyContin, okay.
Purdue Pharma. $35 billion in revenue as a result of the sale of OxyContin. Busted by the feds, the final arrangement was a $600 million fine and several executives sentenced to community service. That's it. That's it. Then we recently had another major bust of a pharmaceutical company called Insys, I-N as in Nancy, S-Y-S. They arrested the founder, John Kapoor, K-A-P-O-O-R. Again, these companies and others like them, what they basically do is racketeering. They approach doctors, for instance, through their representatives, and they convince these doctors that, hey, this drug is really not that dangerous. It can be used long term, and it can be used for many, many conditions beyond what it's been approved for by the FDA. So don't worry about a thing. Just prescribe the drugs. In some cases, these doctors are paid outright by the pharmaceutical companies. So this is essentially RICO racketeering on a wide scale. So I said to my inside source, well, the DEA must be aware. I mean, I was, you know, already knocked off the chair by this information. I said, well, the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, must be aware that there are distributors and pharmaceutical manufacturers who are knowingly engaged in trafficking large shipments of opioid pills to very unlikely places. He said, oh yes. I said, so what prevents the DEA from marching through the door, making arrests, and saying we are now freezing several of these current shipments before they go out because we know that you're involved in trafficking? And he said, well, that has now become much more difficult than it was before, because of a law, federal law, that was passed in 2016, signed by Obama, called the Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Enforcement Act of 2016. I said, well, why is that? He said, because inside that bill, there was a section which basically put a straitjacket on the DEA that raised the bar much higher on what the DEA would have to prove or show before it could march into a pharmaceutical company and claim that they were going to freeze a shipment of opioids that they knew were trafficking. Now they would have to prove what's called immediate threat. That means immediate threat of grave harm or death as the standard. I said, well, what does the word immediate mean? He said, exactly. It used to be imminent. Now it's immediate, which means right now. I said, you mean this minute? He said, this minute. I said, well, that sounds like intentionally perverse language that was put into the bill in order to make it virtually impossible for the DEA to get permission to do their job. He said, exactly. I said, and this bill was passed, he said, virtually unanimously in both houses. He said, the people in Congress had no idea what they were voting on. They hadn't read that section, or if they had, they didn't understand it. They didn't realize what the language implied. They just blithely voted for it. And in fact, he confirmed, as the Washington Post has reported, that one of the original composers or writers of this bill had originally worked for the DEA. going up against the pharmaceutical companies for opioid trafficking, and then he left the DEA, as many other people have, and went to work in 2011 for the drug industry. He knew all the weaknesses of the DEA, and he helped to sculpt the law to raise the bar so high that the DEA is now just throwing up their hands. What are they going to do? They know what the pipeline looks like, but they are paralyzed by this new law that's now about a year old, which I found even more incredible.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know
if it's possible the general
to go
outline
back and
of what's happened.
Write a section, John. I don't know if it's possible to go back and remove a section from a law. You have to get probably have to change the whole law and start over. Do you know how that works?
I don't know how the repeal process would work,
yeah,
but
I've
heard the word repeal used. So it seems to me that they would have to repeal the entire law in order to start over.
Yeah,
I mean, it would be a fairly simple process if everybody knew what they were doing. They would say, look, we're going to repeal the law. We're going to eliminate this section that is so heinous, and then we're going to, you know, re-vote the law back into effect minus that section. It's not rocket science if people are on board with it and understand it.
John, is anybody other than you talking about this?
The reason that I'm talking about this so much, and I have been talking about it a lot lately and writing about it, is because I don't think anybody else is presenting the whole picture. There are many articles that you can read that will give you parts here and there, pieces here and there, but not a coherent picture of the whole situation. And that was the thing that alerted me that I needed to put the pieces together, because people have to understand what's going on here. I mean, I've been researching the horrendous effects of pharmaceuticals in general for many years now. But as far as a single situation is concerned, I have never seen anything like this. This is worse as a kind of singular expanding event than anything in the pharmaceutical arena that I've ever seen, because it's happening so fast. On the other side of the coin, and here is, you know, an irony. You've got legitimate patients who are in agonizing pain as a result of, say, surgery, cancer, whatever. And because there is such fear and timidity now within the medical profession, legitimate doctors, let's call them, it now has become much harder for many patients to even get a prescription for opioids, because there is fear, well, suppose we write something that we shouldn't write as a prescription and it turns out that we're liable and we could get sued and so on and so forth. So there is that.
And yeah, then I've heard about that. We've talked about that on the show with Ray, with Red Lawhern and others.
There's one more piece here that I should put in, and this I think is key. The pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession could easily get by in terms of painkillers with morphine and maybe several of the more powerful opioids, just a few. Doesn't take a genius to figure this out. But I started to research the lists of opioid drugs, pharmaceuticals. Some of them are standalone for opioids. Others are combination drugs, opioids with other medicines. And I stopped counting at 50.
Oh, my.
There are many more. Many more. I would. My guess would be 100. Now, this is what is causing the street epidemic of opioids, because there are so many different versions and pills and so forth available. Reasonably looking at this, it would be possible for legitimate pharmaceutical companies and doctors to control to a much greater degree the illegal spillover of opioids if you were only dealing with a few drugs that are effective. But no, because of the profit motive, because pharmaceutical companies are always searching out new markets and niche markets and this and that, they are just avaricious in their effort to develop and market new opioids. And so naturally, once you get up into this level of 50 drugs and more, the control issue becomes extremely difficult.
Wow. Do you have any estimates on how many of the people, let me move a little closer to the mic, folks. I've been sitting back and taking notes here. What percentage of addicts got started on pain medications legitimately prescribed?
I've looked into that, and I don't see any answers out there. I think common sense would say many start out that way, but not as many as you would think. Because of the fascination with drug taking in general, I think there are many, many addicts who just started out, hey, I'm looking for a drug. I'm not in severe pain. And somebody comes along and says, well, I can get you some really good stuff, and it's going to produce a tremendous high, which it does for many people initially. But then comes the, you know, yeah, usual progression.
My sense is that, too, that there's, that the numbers who actually go from prescribed drugs, say, for surgery, to full-blown addiction, with the abusive taking of the drugs and so on, I don't think is as high as – I'm not sure it's most of these people at all.
Right.
We do need to get better data on it. I sort of get the same kinds of feedback that John's getting of an inexactitude about it.
Also,
it's very
you
important
have to look at
because
this, Peter. Here's another little factor, which is that much of what is now the heroin addiction in America is coming out of opioid addicts who are cut off from their supply for one reason or another. They can't find their dealer doesn't have any pills at the moment, whatever it is, or they were getting prescriptions from a doctor and the doctor realized that it was going too far and he said no more. So many of those people now move into street heroin because heroin is another opioid. Now you are dealing with all sorts of levels of contamination, in addition to the harm caused by the heroin itself, because heroin is notoriously stepped on, you know, 50 different ways with different contaminants and so on and so forth, many of which are harmful in and of themselves, especially when injected. So that is another factor that is entering in here.
Yeah. So it's people who can't get their drugs from doctors who have been cut off will be turning to heroin, and heroin addicts who can't get their heroin will be turning to the opioids, it sounds
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. There you go.
One of the things that we see in states like New York is where the system is now set up so that if I prescribe a scheduled drug, which would include all the pain meds and then the sedatives and tranquilizers, like the benzos, Valium and so on, Xanax especially, I have to check and see that the patient hasn't already got overlapping prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into the New York State system and do that. I give them so seldom. I give them very occasionally for people undergoing withdrawal from other drugs. I might give them 3 days of Valium to go through a crisis of overstimulation that they're dealing with coming off an antidepressant. So just, you know, only if they've been on drugs very short term. Or I'll give it to them more long term if I'm taking them off benzos. I have to prescribe benzos to take them off. But this, the fact that doctors now are required to check and there's a system for checking has made it harder for addicts to get their drugs by doctor shopping. And
right.
That is also swelling the ranks of the heroin addicts. And it's into people taking carfentanil and other things. So, again, you know, the solutions aren't easy. There's built-in unintended effects.
Absolutely. And, you know, it depends upon where you live, but there are many areas where opioid pills on the street are abundantly available because of the trafficking that's going on. That is not part of the prescribing, you know, the legitimate prescribing, let's say. So you're just finding many, many, many more people who are taking these drugs of all ages and all sectors of the, any way you want to stratify society, you're going to find many, many, many addicts, all sorts of people. When I wrote my first article on opioids, a reader wrote me who lives in Ohio, and he said, let me tell you that where I live, I walk down the street and I see the people that you're talking about. It isn't infrequent that I see them, and they look like zombies. They're around.
Yeah. So it's really organized crime. It's interesting.
Yes.
Peter Goetze, whom I talked about in the introduction, whom I spent a lot of time with over this past weekend, he calls the pharmaceutical industry organized crime now, the whole industry. Mm-hmm. And that's without even talking about the intentional overproduction of drugs. It must be very complicated, because I know there was a time when the DEA, years and years ago, when the DEA was concerned about the overuse of Ritalin, they did a report, a really important report about the adverse effects of the stimulant drugs, the amphetamine for ADHD, the amphetamines. Ritalin is methylphenidate, is really very much like an amphetamine, generally classified together with the amphetamines. And for a while, the DEA had set limits for the production of DEA by the drug companies. So, and there was a hue and cry by NAMI and the psychiatry organizations that not there for a brief period of time, there was not enough stimulant around to meet the growing needs of the ADHD community of patients. And of course,
Gene Hazlip at the DEA was one of the main guys who said, hey, these are bad drugs. And he eventually retired.
Thank you for reminding me of his name. He was just going into retirement, which may have enabled him more to take that position. But so the FDA, at least back then, could actually control production itself, but maybe not so much anymore. Is that another thing for you to check out? Maybe we'll get together and follow up on some of these issues?
Well, I am 99% sure that the FDA cannot regulate the amount of production. I mean, that's just not in their bailiwick. They will approve a drug as safe and effective. It goes on the market.
No, did I say FDA? DEA.
DEA. No. You know, they can't upfront say to a pharmaceutical company, you can only make so much of this drug.
You know, I remember around the time of Hazlip that came up. Would you check out a few things and talk to us again about them? You're going to stay on today till 5. But
yeah, I will try. I'll see what I can find out.
Check
about
out the legislative issue. Can they go in there and just put in a bill modifying the original bill under Obama, which I don't imagine Obama knew about. I don't think the presidents know diddly about what's in legislations, unless it's a favorite one of theirs.
Well, actually, I have to tell you, the Washington Post reached out to both Obama and Loretta Lynch, who at the time of this law that we're talking about was the attorney general over the DEA, and asked them to, you know, talk about this law, and they both refused.
Wow.
Refused. I mean, so if they didn't know about it before, they knew about it then, and they said...
So they reached out to Obama, to the administration,
oh, yeah,
and to Loretta Lynch at the...
Yeah, this was in a Washington Post article, because they did a big expose on some of what I'm talking about here. And as in the middle of the article, they said, you know, we reached out to Obama and Lynch, and they both declined to speak about the law.
Mm-hmm. God, this is so interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's incredibly bizarre. I mean, I would bet, big, that the DEA, straitjacketed as it is now, would have absolutely no chance of saying to a pharmaceutical company, you can only manufacture the following amount of fentanyl.
Yeah, well, let's check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have you on or just make a brief follow-up report to people.
Sure.
Maybe about the legislation. Maybe I could even start a new policy of sometimes having people follow up for 10 minutes on important issues.
Sure.
I would find that interesting. And also this issue of how many people who end up being addicts got started by legitimate treatment for pain. And I'm suspecting it may be relatively small compared to the people who are just looking for drugs and partying, or have been addicted to a different kind of drug and now run into the opiates.
So would I, yeah.
Yeah,
I,
that would be
I would say
really
that
interesting. Go ahead.
I have never seen any kind of estimate of that in all the everything I've read. I've never seen anybody estimate, you know, where is it all coming from? Who are these people? Did they start off as legitimate patients?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I agree with your friend who says the pharmaceutical industry is organized crime. And, I mean, I could offer some evidence of that myself. We're talking about, you know, long-term organized crime. In this instance, with opioids, it's a situation where everybody standing around knows what's going on. It's obvious. They know what the pipeline is. They know where the drugs are ultimately coming from. They know that the drug companies know that certain gigantic shipments that they're sending out are trafficking shipments. It's just everybody standing there looking at everybody, and everybody knows exactly what's happening. And at the moment, the DEA seems powerless to stop it.
And it would be more likely the DEA that could do something, I would think, because, well, I was going to say, because the lobbyists have the congressmen, in money strangleholds, but probably people in the DEA are as directly influenced or more so than people in the legislatures. Who knows?
Well, the Washington Post article did mention the revolving door.
Yes.
I mentioned earlier that this one particular guy who worked at the DEA that eventually turned around and went to work for the drug industry, the Post said, in recent years, this revolving door has increased considerably. Numbers of people have left the DEA and gone to work for the pharmaceutical industry. So it seems to be on the upswing. And there again, it's the influence, it's the money. The drug company is saying to somebody at the DEA, you know, you could really help us out here. And I don't know what you're making as a civil servant, but I mean, you know, let me write down a figure on a piece of paper and see what you think. And they show it, and the guy just, you know, falls off his chair and says, wow, that's my college education for my kids. It's my house payments for the next 10 years. My God, you know, what am I doing? And they just turn around and walk out the door.
Yeah. Yeah, that's happened at NIMH and happened at NIMH with one of the top people there. Right at the time of the big Prozac controversy that I had stirred up in the early 1990s. He left and went to work for Eli Lilly. It was pretty bizarre.
Wow. The Westbecker case, right?
The Westbecker case was one of the 150 cases that I was the scientist for.
Wow.
All of which got manipulated into non-existence by the power and money of Eli Lilly. It's another whole, God, I've spent a whole show on that. And I've written about that, folks, most extensively in Medication Madness. I have a really lengthy discussion of just what organized crime Eli Lilly perpetrated in order to get past all the malpractice, rather product liability suits that were against them, with me as the main scientist for all of them. Mm-hmm. It was a quite stunning manipulation of the court in which they were, one state court said, the key state court said, we think that there may be fraud here and that certainly Lilly had manipulated the system, the judicial system. Yet once again, they got out scot-free, uncovered by the press and so on.
Yes.
Amazing.
Well, you know, I go back to, I don't know how many years ago this was for me, maybe 7 or 8, but the review in the Journal of the American Medical Association, July 26, 2000, Dr. Barbara Starfield, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, she was a revered public health expert, died several years ago. And her review was called, Is U.S. Health Really the Best in the World? And she said every year the FDA-approved pharmaceuticals correctly prescribed kill 106,000 Americans. That would be over 1 million deaths a decade. And since then, I've reported on that many times, and I've tried to get major media interested in looking into this at some depth with absolutely no response whatsoever. And I've accumulated other confirming studies that have been published since that one. And I interviewed her about a year and a half before she died, and I said, has the federal government, to your knowledge, ever tried to fix this horrendous situation? And this was an email interview. And she answered that question, capital N, capital O. And I said, has the federal government ever approached you to, you know, take part as a role of a consultant to help them remedy this? Again, capital N, capital O. Everybody, it's another one of these, everybody knows who needs to know. The FDA knows, the drug companies know, doctors know, many, many doctors know by this point, and nothing is being done about it. So when your friend says the pharmaceutical industry is organized crime, I mean, here it is. 1 million deaths per decade. Now, anybody... You know, whenever I say this on a radio show or I write this, I know that for most people, they don't even remember me saying it because it's too much cognitive dissonance to absorb. A million
yes.
deaths per decade yeah. from FDA-approved pharmaceutical drugs, not just two or three drugs, but the entire spectrum? And how much fraud does that imply about studies that are published in prestigious journals detailing clinical trials of these killer drugs that are given a green light and are said to be safe and effective in the, you know, the most prestigious medical journals in the world? I mean, not just now and then, but on a routine basis. So the level of rank fraud in the literature itself is unstoppable in order to end up with a million deaths per decade. You've got to be doing some serious lying and cheating in order to get a pass on that.
Well, you know, I think it might even be more than 100,000.
I think it is myself. She told me it is. Starfield okay. said, this is a conservative estimate, and other studies that have been done since then peg the figure higher. And the reason that I use hers is because people will come back at me and say, well, you know, who did the study, and where was it published, and is this really reputable, or are these just fringe researchers? So I said, look, I'll give you the most mainstream of mainstream here. Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, revered public health expert for decades, Journal of the American Medical Association. There you go. This is open source literature, mainstream, meticulous credentials of everybody up and down the line. And nobody does anything about it.
Yeah. I'm just Googling as we talk, and the estimate of here's one that's talking about 783,000, almost a million people, annual deaths from conventional medicine.
Well, that would be, yeah, I think I know who that is. That was an independent researcher a few years ago. Who's really taking a look at what mainstream does not want to look at. Absolutely, sure. I mean, take that one. 700,000 every... Just do a little extrapolating and see what you come up with. I don't know what the actual figure is, and I don't know if anybody does, but it's certainly higher than a million deaths per decade. But still, that alone, even that, is mind-boggling.
It is. It is. It's quite amazing.
And this doesn't even take into account the people that are maimed, whose lives are destroyed, who are debilitated. People should look up Donald Light, L-I-G-H-T, who wrote a paper and also a book about adverse effects of medications. We're talking serious effects.
Yeah.
In the millions and millions and millions. These are
I've got his book on my shelves, but I don't think I can get to it and keep the show going properly.
Right. Yeah, I don't know whether I can Google it in time, but I wrote about...
That's another thing. Just make a list of stuff, and I'd just love to fill in on some of these complicated issues. You know, what kind of data and estimates do we have of total drug deaths? Total deaths related to medical care. Let's spread it out to that. And then total deaths related to prescribed medication.
Okay, well, I can give you some figures.
Go ahead.
I can give you some figures. I just found this. Let's see. Okay, so this is Donald Light. And the citation on it would be, let's see here. It's a rather long article that I wrote, so I'm looking for it here. But, okay, appropriate prescribed prescription drugs, fourth leading cause of death. About 330,000 patients die each year from prescription drugs in the U.S. and Europe. epidemic of about 6.6 million per year hospitalizations.
Wow.
As well as falls, road accidents, and about 80 million per year medically minor problems, such as pains, discomforts, and dysfunctions that hobble productivity or the ability to care for others. Okay? This comes from the American Psychological Association publication called Footnotes, November 2014. The article is titled "The Epidemic of Sickness and Death from Prescription Drugs." Donald W. Light, professor of medical and economic sociology, founding fellow of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, et cetera, et cetera. He's got other credentials. So there you have that. Starfield in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2000 said that the medical system as a whole kills 225,000 people a year in the United States.
Yeah.
And, of course, she later told me that was a conservative estimate. 106,000 from prescription drugs and 119,000 from medical mistreatment and errors in hospitals.
One of the things that I've been doing a lot of work on, John, and that you probably don't even know about and my wonderful audience is just learning about, is that I recently became convinced that, a vegetable-based diet, I'd really call it better just eating, a better approach to eating that includes a vegetable-based, plant-based diet with zero dairy and low fat is life-changing in general health and in multiple specific illnesses. And I've now lost 32 pounds since April 1st coming off of these things. And I didn't have a very bad diet, but I dropped even the fatty vegetables like the oils. There were, according to Pam Popper, and I'm believing her, there are no good oils. There's no good fats because they're all fat. That the dairy is not meant for human beings. And I eat a lot of sweet potatoes and potatoes. And for lunch, I mix together a sweet potato with some rice. And actually, now it tastes so good to me, I don't even bother with condiments. And my wife is completely recovered from 30 years of inflammatory bowel disease.
Wow.
And I've recovered from the supposedly inevitable mild hypertension of old age. In fact, I got faint on the diet, and I realized it wasn't the diet at all. I thought, see, this isn't good for me. It's weakening me. No, my blood pressure had gone down. By the time I could get to the blood pressure cuff, it had gone down to 105 because my lowest dose of available of antihypertensive medication was putting me into hypotension.
Wow.
Now I have the blood pressure of a young man. I mean, well within anybody's standards. So I'm really, and if you put this up, you put proper eating up against taking insulin for your diabetes and so many other things, taking pain meds for this and that, and of course, antidepressants and then drugs for emotional problems. If people ate right, we would be saving, I think, millions of lives per year in the United States. Millions. I don't know which is worse, actually, the statins or heart disease in terms of the misery being caused. Probably ultimately heart disease, but the statins are very destructive.
I think it's great. I mean, I'm very happy to hear this. One of my basic reaction, aside from thinking it's terrific what you're saying, is that it makes such a difference when MDs speak out about this, what you're saying, as opposed to, let's say, nutritional counselors, so-called holistic practitioners,
right,
alternative practitioners. They are in danger of getting slammed.
Yes.
I mean, seriously slammed. Because they can't protect themselves as well. MDs have a better chance of protecting themselves and also reaching out to a wider audience when people say, well, this guy's a doctor. I mean, look what he did. Look what he's found. It's let me look into this. So I think it's splendid what you're saying.
Thank you. One of the things I'm seeing is that when I suggest to my clients that they, my patients or clients, that they look into this, they get pretty quick results often, very quick results in just their overall well-being. It's not going to go in there and cure some biochemical imbalance because they don't exist, but it will improve your overall health, which will improve your overall well-being, and it can help with the inflammatory reactions that come along with withdrawing from psychiatric meds. And I'm getting feedback from a number of my patients that when they've gone to their internist and showed them this diet and the very simple pyramid that explains a lot of it, because it is, it's basically a vegetable-based diet that's low-fat and non-dairy, and the low-fat includes fatty vegetables. And it's not, it doesn't say no meat, it just says keep your meat down to maybe twice a week or something. And I haven't eliminated meat. I've accomplished all of this while eating about 6 ounces of smoked salmon and a little organic organic chicken, which is very highly recommended by the nutritionist Pam Popper. If you're going to eat animal, eat organic and probably chicken and or fish caught in the ocean, you know. Literally, saying Atlantic salmon isn't enough. That could be farm bred Atlantic salmon. It has to be freely caught. Forget the word for it, salmon. So it's not a diet that puts you into being a vegan. Although Pam is joking that she now knows 3 vegan psychiatrists, and the 3 of us were all at the conference. Folks, you got to sign up for this conference next year. It's just amazing. I mean, meet vegan psychiatrists who don't believe in drugs. But internists who have been looking at this quite often say, well, this looks, you know, this canned urchin, it looks like a very sound diet. It's the diet we had until 10,000 years ago when we got into raising farm animals and went into dairy business. So we really grew through millions of years of evolution as that led up to us with very little meat eating along the way. I mean, gorillas, chimps, and so on do a little meat eating, and all humans around the world, all cultures have some meat eating, but the ones that are healthy have very minimal meat eating, 5%, 10% of their calories, you know.
Right.
So I'm certainly doing a lot better, folks. And my wife is, Ginger is just back to her best self. It's amazing. Beautiful. And, you know, she was in chronic pain from shifting joint pains, which go along with her ulcerative colitis, and then the horrible gut pains and so on and so forth, and that's gone. I mean, she still gets pains here and there from different things, and so do I, but she's a 66-year-old lady who doesn't, you know, have these major diseases that she had for many, many years, documented by a biopsy and so on. So this is wonderful. I see we have 1 minute left. I basically need to say goodbye to my wonderful guest, John Rappaport, and it's Rappaport. And John is nomorefakenews.com. John is a very, very reliable, courageous, outstanding journalist. It's an honor to know you and have you on the show, John.
Likewise, Peter. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and good wishes to my wonderful, wonderful audience, and start thinking about your general health more and more.